Whether you've been through it now or you will go through it later, losing a loved one is not an easy thing to do. And many of us that have gone through it, we know the pain associated to it. We know the difficulty and the grief around it. But how does one actually overcome that grief? How does one go through that grief? How does one learn to be a better person through going through something that difficult? Today, we're going to be talking with a special guest about what it looks like to die gracefully and how we can learn as a community, as chaplains, as imams, and as community members to move forward together. Hey everyone, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Hope you're doing well. This is Nihal Khan back with another episode of Faith in Fine Print. It's a beautiful fall day here in Istanbul, and we have another special guest with us. And this guest is going to talk to us about her work in the community as a chaplain, as somebody that provides care to people in a hospital and also in a greater capacity. We have with us Sunduz Khuluqi, who is also an author of Musings of a Muslim Chaplain. You can check out her book online. And we're going to be talking to her, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum, Sundus.
Wa alaikum salam, Nihal. Thank you for having me.
How's it going?
It's going well, alhamdulillah.
How's Turkey treating you?
Beautifully. This country is amazing.
Alhamdulillah. So tell us a little about yourself. We don't usually do intros or reading intros off of a paper. So tell us about yourself, what you're doing, what you're up to, what your goals are, etc.
Oh, wow. Okay. 10-year plan or 5-year plan?
It's your call.
Bismillah, my name is Sundus. I was born in Damascus. My parents moved to Southern California when I was just under 2 years old. I've been there ever since. Grew up as typical American Muslim in a very robust kind of Muslim active community. I found out about chaplaincy around 2012 or 2013. It was after I had gotten married, had my kids, and I was really searching for what my purpose was. What is it that I want to do with my time, with my life? And all of the things that I was interested in terms of passion, seemed really disparate. So, for instance, I loved religion. I just loved learning about religion. Didn't have to be my own. It could be any other person's tradition, how people come to God, how they connect with Him. I was really into interfaith work at the time. So I didn't know that there was a career that I could make out of any of that, right? So I just did a little bit of volunteering work here and there at the masjid with interfaith, etc. And then I happened to cross paths with Chaplain Soheib Sultan, Allah have mercy on his soul, at a family camp in 2013. And just subhanAllah, just seeing him before he even said anything, he just exuded this compassion, this prophetic gentleness that I had not seen before. And again, this was during a time where I was really searching for what it is that I wanted to do. But I saw him and I thought to myself, whatever that man is doing, professionally or personally, I want that. So of course, I followed him around for the next few days at camp. And the more he talked about chaplaincy, and talked about being with people, guiding people, being there for them during really difficult moments, I was like, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. And he told me about, the education, training background. And I was in such shock. I couldn't believe that there was an actual path laid out for this. I thought I had to kind of cobble something together to get my way through it. And so I've been practicing chaplaincy in the hospital setting primarily for the past 6 years now, alhamdulillah. And then just started with police chaplaincy a little bit and community chaplaincy as well.
Talking about chaplaincy as a career, often people will hear the term thrown around a lot. And when you actually study, what chaplaincy is, you often see that it associated with like a Christian minister or a Christian pastor. What does it look like within the Muslim context? Obviously, as a chaplain, you probably go see people of all different faiths, but it's helpful when a Muslim is administering to another Muslim, because they appreciate that aspect. They appreciate having somebody of their own faith that's able to talk to them about difficulties in their life, whether they're in the hospital. And I'd love to focus on that aspect of your work in the hospital as to providing care? Like, what does that look like on a day-to-day basis?
So what's interesting about my role is that I work at two hospitals during the week. One of them, I am the only chaplain on staff during my shift. Mm-hmm. So I see anybody and everybody under the sun. I'm not the Muslim chaplain, I'm the chaplain. At the other hospital, I am the Muslim chaplain. So I only see Muslim patients and their families and staff. And I really feel the difference in my role. So when I am ministering or serving Muslim patients and families, there's a lot of explaining that I have to do in the very beginning. So I come in using the words, I'm very intentional about introducing myself as chaplain. So this can be a contentious issue amongst Muslim chaplains. Some feel that we should embrace an entirely different term or introduce other terms that would be more maybe familiar to us. I don't know what that would be. Some of my like male counterparts can get away with imam. But I feel strongly against that because that's not something that I can adopt. I'm not going to call myself an imama. So I introduce myself saying, you know, Assalamu alaikum, my name is Sundus. I'm a chaplain with the spiritual care department. So I'm intentional about using all of those words together. At the hospital that I serve at, we get a lot of international Muslim patients and families. And so there begins kind of me starting to unravel and describe to them what it is that I do. Because first they're taken aback by, oh my gosh, there's a Muslim. You work here? Are you with the masjid? No, I work here. I'm employed by the hospital. What can you do for me, right, is the next question. And it's really, really hard to capture, as you know, Nihad, doing CPE yourself and having some chaplaincy training in the hospital. It goes beyond, I'm here to make dua for you. I can do a lot more than dua, right? I'm here to read Quran for you. Yeah, I can do that too. I'm here to listen to you vent. Yeah, that's a part of it as well. So it's really unpacking a lot of that terminology. How I like to define chaplain, usually when people ask me what that means, is somebody who supports people emotionally and spiritually in times of crisis. And so again, that's kind of a really vague general definition and doesn't quite entirely capture what I do. And that's why I wrote Musings of a Muslim Chaplain, is because instead of trying to explain it to people, I figured, you know what, I just want to show you what I do. So the book is essentially a compilation of vignettes of patient encounters that I've had at the hospital, where it focuses on different aspects of my job day to day. So to answer your question, that could look like, you know, a big part of it is rounding, what we call rounding. So I'll go to the units in the hospital, I'll check in with the nurses, with the charge nurses, intentional about staff care. So making sure that we're taking care of our people there who are taking care of the patients. And just, I've been told just the presence of chaplains on the unit just makes them feel a lot better and feel a lot comfortable. From there, I'll just ask them, I'll say, are there any patients today who you feel like need a little bit additional support? Whether that means they're getting a diagnosis, like the doctor is going to go in there soon and give them some bad news. Or we have patients at the end of life who have transitioned to comfort care. Or there are patients who are just really anxious who don't enjoy being in the hospital. Or there are patients who don't have family or friends or relatives. They're here from out of town. They were visiting and they found themselves in the hospital and they need some company, right, or additional support. It could look like any number of things. And so majority of my referrals come from the nurses, from the doctors, social workers. So it's an interdisciplinary team, right? We're all referring each other. Go in, I do my introduction to the patient. With Muslims, I'm still, to be honest with you, it's been 6 years now, and I'm still trying to find, like, what, I do something different every time. So there's no formula yet. Part of it is, yes, breaking down, defining what chaplain is, and then at the end, it's just, like, finding the right questions to ask to be able to allow them to feel like they can talk about what's going on. Because there are so many layers to what it means to be Muslim and what spiritual care for Muslims can be. So a big part of my role, of my job, is establishing rapport and building a relationship so that somebody feels like they could even open up to me. So before I can even say anything or ask them anything or get down to like the deep work of the inner work that needs to be done with the patient, it's about just like small talk, you know, building up to the bigger conversation, checking in on them, understanding how their family works, their dynamics, what are they finding challenging, I know I'm like going off into kind of a black hole, but perhaps my trying to explain it to you is just a reflection of me trying to still figure out how to accurately, I guess, convey all that it is that a chaplain can do in terms of services. Like, there's not like a laundry list of things that I can just pull out, right? I'm gonna throw it back to you.
You know, I'm actually thinking about a book, The Medieval Muslim Hospital by Dr. Ahmad Rajab, where he talks about, from a historical perspective, what healing looked like in the mm-hmm. Muslim world, and specifically speaking about it in the context of when Europe was in like the Dark Ages in like 7th century, 9th century. You know, you had all these, what they would call the Bimaristan, which was,
yeah,
which actually mm-hmm. in Persian and in Urdu, Bimar actually mm-hmm. means sick. Mm-hmm. So it's a place to become cured.
Yes.
And the idea today, and we see this specifically in the United States, about the terrible failing nature of healthcare in America. Like yeah. it's abhorrent. It's right. horrible.
Yeah.
Right. You'd step foot in a hospital and breathe three times. You leave with a $40,000 bill. Right. And automatically we assume that healing only occurs in a physical context. So within chaplaincy, right, having done hospital chaplaincy myself, you forget that the chaplain's not just there to, you know, bury your loved ones or to help, like you said, help you read Quran. Actually, there's access that the chaplain gets in the hospital to patients, to rooms and floors that even physicians don't get, because there's information that they'll share with you of a non-medical nature that you're able to then convey to the social worker. You're That's able right. to convey to somebody that can kind of make a secondary diagnosis about this person. If you go to certain floors, like I remember when I would go to the cardiac floor, right? People that have heart disease and whatnot, the oft-repeated issues that they're talking about are issues with their families or issues with other people, like interpersonal relations. Right. And only in the modern era are people now beginning to kind of look at that, yes, there is a psychosomatic element to healing that people are not looking at, that people consistently, even like the physicians, when they'll come into the room, it's like, I don't know about you, but I've actually seen this where I've had to kind of pull a doctor or a nurse aside or report them because of the utter lack of compassion they yes. show for their patients.
Right.
Like they're just another number that this person is sitting there. They get 3.5 minutes of your time. You tell them two or three things and you move on. So it's a very automated corporate process.
Yeah.
And we see that now permeating into every element of healthcare, where it's not about care. It's actually just about making money for the hospital or making money for the insurance company.
Right.
But the point I found about chaplaincy, especially having been here from this, I've had a very interesting perspective. I was an imam who was working as an imam, but also doing his chaplaincy, where I remember a certain person who was intubated and they couldn't speak. And all I could do was go and recite some Quran for them and kind of rendezvous with the family and things of that nature. And eventually that said individual passed away and I ended up even going and burying them, right? So you have this process that comes together, but it was the first time where I actually saw out of the, I don't know how many people I've buried, but out of all those people where you're able to actually work with the family from the point where you actually have some amount of authority to do something in the hospital, into bringing them out to have their last rites taken care of, which mm-hmm. I kind of want to go on to this next aspect. I don't think we as a Muslim community know how to embrace death or talk about death or prepare ourselves for it. Now, I don't want to confuse anybody. It does, you know, death is not one of those things that if you prepare yourself enough for it, like you'll be okay. Like, no, when it strikes, right?
Right.
When you lose a family member, prepping for it doesn't make it any easier. But when it comes to our approaches, I think that like when you go to the masjid, X, Y, and Z person passed away, nobody knows who their family members are. Nobody knows how to talk to them. You see them crying. Like nobody actually knows, okay, how do you do a proper ta'ziyah? Like how do you actually assist this family in mourning their loved one, right? How do you help them dispose of their loved one's things? Who's there in their support? How do you help them wash a body, right? Like all these difficult things that we only go through the motions, but we don't actually go through, like, what does it look like to go through this? Or even worse, right? It's like the getting lost in the legalities and the finances of like the graveyard, the masjid, right. and logistics and hospital.
Yeah.
Like, but how can we kind of humanize that process from your own experience?
Yeah. Speaking of medieval Europe, so I'm thinking of a kind of a handbook that came out of that following the bubonic plague, where I believe like 2/3 of the population was wiped out. Death upon death, bodies, you know, piling up in the streets. Out of that came a piece of literature from the Christian tradition, which is called Ars Moriendi, right? The art of dying, essentially. And what these clergy members, I think it was an anonymous writer, like they didn't know who actually wrote it. It could be a compilation by other clergy. On how to die well, like what does a good death look like from the Christian perspective? And so they started it from like, well, what is the role of the community? Exactly as you're saying, what are the role of the family members? What is the role of the person who's dying? What does it look like to die well and within kind of like that Christian framework? And so, alhamdulillah, I think that we have a lot in our tradition, but it's just not in like one single source where we can pick it up kind of like a handbook and say, okay, this is something that can guide us on. But inshallah, that's in the works. I won't say too much about that. Mm-hmm. But Ars Moriendi, Muslim version coming up. But there's so much to say about this. And I'm thinking specifically of a patient who I saw just before I came to Istanbul. It was a ICU patient. And they weren't Muslim, but they were brown. So similar kind of worldview approach to death, if we can say maybe death denying. And what happened was that the patient himself was able to talk and articulate his needs. I met him in the emergency room when he came in, very sick man. And his wife was at bedside, and I was basically there to support the wife. Because she was freaking out, understandably, right? Her husband was very sick. And I sat with her for a good hour and change. And she, just like you said, she just talked about their relationship, about their life. And I was trying to start to introduce this idea, knowing from the staff, you know, they pull me aside and say, this man is very sick. He's going to the ICU. Starting to understand from her, well, you know, auntie, did your husband ever talk about what he would want at the end of life. Do you think he would want to be in the hospital? How does he feel about it, et cetera? She's like, no, we never talk about this. And mind you, the man has been sick, right? So it's not coming as a surprise. So kind of left it alone. Okay, there was nothing there done. He was admitted into the ICU overnight, declined rapidly. So I came into work the next morning. He was not conscious, unable to articulate his concerns, his needs, his desires, his preferences, all of that chance was gone. And so now it came down to his wife and one of his adult children to make all of these decisions. And it was declining so quickly that the doctors were essentially preparing them for kind of that death talk, right? You ready to transition your loved one, right? We use these words, transition into stopping treatment, withdrawing that treatment, stopping treatment, and moving into kind of like a comfort approach, right, where they're not suffering. And the auntie said, this is not fair. She said, why do they expect us to make this decision? She's like, if you're asking me whether I want to stop treating my husband and letting him die, no, of course not. And for you to expect me to answer any other way is unethical. And so I'm like, I get that, right? We're asking them at a really critical time where emotions are really high. They're in complete shock, a little bit of denial, because this happened literally overnight. And it's like, he was walking into the hospital yesterday. Now you're telling me that he's dying and almost dead? Like there's I need a second opinion sort of approach. And that just kind of frames this conversation around, I see this over and over and over again. And I remember the adult child told me, kind of pulled me aside and said, this is my mom's decision. But I will tell you that if my dad had said anything about stop aggressive care, or if I get to this certain point, just don't treat me anymore, let me die. He's like, this would have been so much easier. So I'm like, there's an advanced directive, like there's a pulse, the five wishes, like whatever approach you want to take, there are questions that are asked in a really formalized way that you can have this conversation discussion with your loved one that essentially takes, removes that burden from the loved ones to have to make that in that moment. And that's just even, we're not even scratching the surface of the logistics, as you mentioned, because as Muslims, right, we like an expeditious burial. So we want things done and like turning around in 24 hours. You have to make a lot of decisions in 24 hours. If your loved one ever talked about where they wanted to be buried, who they want to wash their body, what mortuary they want to use, you know, who's going to be taking care of the aza and all of the other, you know, formalities that need to be taken care of. So I've seen this done not so well. And then sometimes you get that one case where it's like, I wish it was like this all the time, where, you know, I'll remember this one family that came in again to the emergency room. And these things happen suddenly, like you said. We can prepare, but we just never really know. But we're prepared, at least something. And that's what happened with this one family. Their loved one came into the emergency room as a code blue. And they tried to resuscitate the patient. It wasn't working. And the physician came out and said, you know, asked the family, do they have an advanced directive? Have they ever said anything about aggressive treatment? And I remember it was something like three siblings, three adult children, and like two who were international, who were speaking by speakerphone on the phone throughout all of this that was happening within a span of 2 hours. And they all said, yeah, we talked to our loved one about this. And they said that they wouldn't want aggressive treatment. They wouldn't want to be intubated. They wouldn't want any kind of heroic measures. And the physician said, well, we're at that point where the next step would be to transition to that. And they said, well, no, our parent doesn't want that. And so they stopped everything. And it was so peaceful. All the siblings were on the same page. There wasn't like intra-family fighting. The physicians weren't feeling what we call kind of like moral distress about the situation, about continuing to resuscitate somebody who really should be just left to pass naturally and not intervene in that way. And they got to spend the final moments with their loved ones in a quiet room where the chaplain could say some prayers, where we can bring the people together, where they talked very quietly about the memories and what they loved about their loved one, right? And they passed, and that was it. Everything was figured out. They knew exactly which mortuary to choose, who was going to be in charge of what. And I can just tell you that everyone, even the staff, was just like, that went so well. And all things considered, it didn't go very well. They lost a loved one, but kind of like we said, the energy in the room, kind of the approach to it, everything was just filled with so much peace. And so it doesn't, you know, it makes sense that in our tradition, our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, the wisest amongst you are the ones who remember death often and prepare for it. So there's something, obviously our Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was very wise with his own words and choosing those things to emphasize, right? So there's a reason why he emphasized that. And there are so many things about even, you know, my teachers point out that everything from the, you know, immediate death to the ghusl and mayyit, the washing of the dead body, the janazah, all of that, everything that we do in terms of ritual and etiquette is meant to remind the living of their mortality. So every piece of it is essentially that for us to take a pause and to reflect and say, oh, wow, okay, like this is real, this happens. And honestly, that's the best part of my job. And it sounds morbid to some people, but the best part of my job and the part that has been most refining for me is that every single day, sometimes multiple times a day, I interact with death. And that has shaped my life so profoundly and helped me to reprioritize things and helped me just to face it every single day and say, this is real, this is going to happen. So what am I doing to prepare for it? And what am I doing with my loved ones? And this is the way it should have been. I think I can talk about this forever, but like modern times, right? We're dying in sterilized rooms. One of the things that I love about Istanbul that we noticed immediately is that there are cemeteries all over, right? So when you're shopping, when you're residential, when you're at touristy areas, you're seeing graves. So you're reminded. It's like a reminder that's in your everyday. Maybe it's in your peripheral vision, but it's there. It's not hidden away. And I think part of the challenge for us, kind of in like a modern context, is how much are we interacting with death? Do we attend janazas of friends and family, right? All of that is like, it's a farz kifaya, right? So this is a obligation upon the community. Again, this is emphasized for a reason in our tradition, right? Everything connects.
Yeah, and I think with that, if you think about it, in the Muslim world, cemeteries were either placed right outside the city walls, or they were scattered like they are here in Istanbul. But what's so interesting, have you ever been to actually a janazah here in Istanbul?
No.
So if you go to a janazah, they'll pass out food and sweets, right? And the first time I remember, me and my wife, we like were passing by a masjid and they were giving away like sweets and food. And there was like, they don't have an ice cream truck out here, but they have like a dessert truck. And the dessert truck's like giving out people stuff. And we're like, oh, like somebody get married? They're like, no, somebody died.
That's so beautiful. I love that so much.
I'm like, wait, what? And you know, the American in me is like, wait, what? This is supposed to be like a morbid experience. Yeah. Everyone's supposed to be crying. Right. You're wearing black. Right. And, you know, I'm so sorry. But no, here they were just like, no, this person's moved on into the akhirah. Yes. Like, what more can you like want for them?
God, they do it so right here. No, I tell my family all the time. I hate it when I say it, but I'm like, when I have, like, while I'm dying, can we do a maudid? Like, let's celebrate this. And it goes back to this. There's a poem by, I think, Imam al-Ghazali that's translated and so beautiful. But in it, he talks about how he says, he's like, my brothers in faith, like, when I die, don't cry. Be happy for me. And he says it, I mean, he's wording it so beautifully. He says something like, the bird has flown from its cage, right? My spirit is now released from its shell. Like, I'm returning to my creator. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Again, this emphasis on what do we say to each other in these like times of crisis, a reminder for ourselves, we're going back. That's where we're meant to be. Our soul is yearning, right? If we're talking about like Mawlana Jalaluddin Rumi in the first few lines of his Masnavi, it's all about this reed flute that is suffering and crying because it's been separated from the reed bed, which is symbolic of us as human beings. We were, you know, our souls were with Allah in pre-eternity, and then they're confined to this physical body, this form, throughout our entire time here in dunya. It's hardship after hardship after hardship. And then we're released from our prison sentence here in dunya, and our soul is released and returns to its creator, returns to home, essentially. Yeah, it's a celebration, 100%.
There's actually a couple lines of poetry you reminded me of. I can't remember who the exact author was, but the Arabic was... الحبس ليس مذهبي وليس فيه طربي ولست أرضى قفصا وإن يكن من ذهبي غابات ربي غايتي والعيش فيها طربي. But it's really interesting because he talks about what seems like a very, very, you know, high up ideal or moral that somebody's aiming to get to, right? He's saying that الحبس ليس مذهبي, that habs, like, you know, being held in a golden cage or a golden home that many of us live in the world, right? We want our McMansions in the boonies, in the suburbs, right? But it's, you know, that's what people are aiming for. And then on top of that, he goes on and says, الحبس ليس مذهبي, it's not my way, right? And he says, وَلَسْتُ أَرْضَى قَفَصًا وَإِنْ يَكُنْ مَذْهَبِي, I don't want to be in a cage, even if it's made of gold. The title, actually, is, you mentioned a bird. The title of the poem is At-Tayr. Like, it's just talking about, like a bird. That's what it's talking about. Yeah. It's as profound yet as simple as that, which is that we are, it's something I heard once, that everyone is trying to make a sandcastle and forget that the waves have been here forever. You know?
Yes.
Like, and everyone thinks that, oh, my sandcastle is going to remain. No, it's not. The waves remain, but your sandcastle won't.
No, that's beautiful. And I mean, that's exactly what I mean when being reminded of that every day at work has been such a gift for me. Like, what really matters at the end of the day. And when you reference this in the beginning of our conversation, it's really the relationships. And I see an end of life. The talk is about how much they love the people who are around them, or the people who are around them, how much they love the person, and reconciliation. It's one of the two. It's the best relationships that have worked during my life, and it's the ones that have been broken and that I really want to fix, or that's keeping me in this life and kind of like emotionally torturing, right, during that active dying phase. So it really does boil down to that relationship.
Yeah, and not only that, the hadith which you had brought up about, you know, the Prophet ﷺ said, أَكْثِرُ بِذِكْرِ هَادِمِ اللَّذَّاتِ, right? يعني الموت. He said that, recall much the destroyer of pleasures, which is death. But people, I think, misunderstand what's actually being said. Mm-hmm. He's not saying that just sit there and say death, 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 mm-hmm. death, death, death. Like you're having a good time, death, right? Like right. you're sitting in a gathering, death, right? Like,
or that's my job.
No. So don't get me wrong, right? You always have this people who tend to speak out of context, right? So X, Y, and Z person will go, and I actually remember this, you know, you go to a wedding and somebody goes and they're giving a speech about death and dying, right? Like, but the truth of it is that that's not the place to sit there and talk right. about death. Similarly, enjoying yourself and having a good time, the place to do that is not the graveyard,
right?
Right? Everything has its place. And the actual identification of what we term oppression in Arabic is putting something where it doesn't belong. Like it's wad'u shay' fi ghayr mahalli, right? That's you know, like that's what people need to keep in mind. So now the Prophet ﷺ, him saying this, that remember the destroyer of pleasures, which is what? Remember remember it often through mentioning it, through having that difficult conversation. Hey, mom or dad, what do you want to do? You know, based on if one of you passes away before the other person, or your siblings, hey, you know, you've made a decent amount of money, you have assets, like, have you thought about what's going to happen in case you pass away or something Absolutely. Happens to you? How do you want to live after your significant other or your, you know, somebody passes away in your life? Like, how do you want life to go on? And often people haven't thought about that, and they'll just say things like, oh, I just want to die as well, right? But that's not emblematic of the sunnah, right? The sunnah doesn't say if your loved one dies, just mm-hmm. go die, right? Mm-hmm. And everyone becomes very morbid, or they go from 0 to 100, like in the case that you mentioned of somebody saying, oh, we don't talk about it. Yeah, you're not talking about it, and it will explode in your face right. if you don't begin to talk about it, right? It's not going to make the death of that person easier, but recovering from it, it will make it easier.
Right. I'm reminded of when we're talking about the son of the Prophet, you know, in his final year, the time that he kind of got the hint that this was going to be his final year, right, was in Ramadan, when Angel Jibreel alayhi salam had him review the Quran twice. And so the Prophet Muhammad, that had not happened before. So that was kind of his hint, like, this is going to be the last Ramadan that we're going to do this. What does the Prophet do? He goes and performs Hajj with his community, right? And he basically does his final sermon and informs the community. He gives them a heads up and says, this is the last time that we're going to be gathering here together. You know, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially that moment of like, do you bear witness that I have fulfilled my mission? So he's asking from his community, first up, he's telling them, giving them the heads up, like, this is happening. So this whole idea of like keeping it from people, or not telling the patient of their diagnosis or that their time is coming to an end, that's not the sunnah. That's not the way of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. It's giving the news, and people were distraught and they were grieving. They had the anticipatory grief, if we want to term it that. And that's okay. Yeah, that you're going to be sad. Yes, it's uncomfortable. And again, part of this chaplaincy, the training is like, how do you deal with the discomfort? How do you learn to be comfortable with the uncomfortable? It, like you said, it doesn't mean that the sadness is going to go away. It doesn't mean that we get to bypass the grief. But what it does do is, getting rid of the logistics, removes an emotional burden, an emotional tax from the entire process logistically, that will actually allow you to have the time and the space to mourn. And that in and of itself is much healthier than trying to distract doing all the other things and then burying the actual emotions. Because as we know, with grief, we don't get over it, we move through it. That's the only way.
Yeah.
That's the only way.
And I think what people don't understand is that there may be dips where you'll feel that it may have to get a little worse before it gets better, right? Like grief, it runs on a cycle. It goes up and down. Some days are easier than others. But speaking from a practical lens, I think I think a lot of times when we talk about death, especially in the Muslim community, and I say this as like somebody that works in a masjid environment, we're always talking about like kullu nafsin dha'iqatul, brothers and sisters, you know, ready yourselves, brothers and sisters, do good deeds, etc., etc. But it's actually very theoretical what I'm saying. What I'm talking about has a little bit of practicality. It gives you individual worth. It gives you individual accountability. But we are not an ummah because we're just individuals. We're an ummah because we come together. So when I talk about a practical form of readying ourselves for death or readying ourselves for a loved one, where does that process honestly begin? I know one thing that I always tell people is to write their wasiyah, right? Write their will before they pass away. Some people still say that, well, I don't have money, right? No, but you have something about you that people love, right? How do you prepare your loved ones, right, for that? Like often even in the case of, and this is a completely different subject, but when you're able to write down how it is that you want to pass away and what you want done, it actually provides relief for your loved ones, right? But in the case of actually, let's say, suicide or somebody takes their own life, it is a complete opposite. It shocks everyone around you, right? That's why, you know, it's one thing that, yes, you're in a certain state and you're in such a difficult state that one is contemplating that. But for one individual, their suffering comes to an end at that point and their loved one's suffering starts, the amount of PTSD that people take away from. But coming back to the point that how can me as an individual prep my spouse, prep my children, prep my friends and family members for my death? Like, what is the right that is due upon them of me passing away?
I think there are two ways to look at it. There's that logistical piece with the wasiyah, inheritance, trust, where do you want to be buried, buying your burial plot, taking care of all of that, right? Where, what mortuary, how do you want to die, where do you want to die, etc. And then there's kind of the medical aspect of it. So if we're talking about like an advanced directive, how far do you want, you know, treatment? How much, you know, how far do you want to go with it, right? Do you, would you want to be intubated? Do you want to be resuscitated? If you're end stage disease or, you know, what does that look like for you, when it comes to medical treatment? So logistical, medical, and then we've got the emotional piece of it. Again, going back to relationships, questions to ask yourself, like, who would I want to wash my body? Who do I want in the room if and not if when I am actively dying? Do I want a big party in my room? Do I want to keep it to two people? Who is in my room? Who do I want to wash my body? Is there a way that I want my family to break the news? Like, how do you want to announce your death? What does that look like for your relationships with the community, with the people who are around you?
I'm just curious on that one. What would that look like? Is there a way that, because like minus, you know, a mass text being sent to the community, I don't know of any other.
Do you, maybe your preference is I don't want it to be via text. Maybe it might be your preference is for whatever reason for your upholding relationships, you want it to be word of mouth so that people can console each other. I don't know. Like, so it's, it might not even be about what do you prefer, but is there something you don't want done, right, in that way? So if we're looking at it from these kind of three different ways, that's when you start to have a conversation. And I'll just give a really brief example. I sat my parents down and my siblings, and this was actually during COVID, I think when we were all really staring our mortality in the face suddenly. And we did a Zoom call where with my siblings, their spouses, my parents, my aging parents, and myself sat down and we did the five wishes together. So it's a series of questions. You can find this online. But we were all really surprised by each other's answers, which is really interesting. So some of us, one of us, my siblings, didn't want anybody in the room while he was dying.
Interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. I would have never guessed that of him. When we were asking each other these questions, I think we would have assumed exactly the opposite of what that person actually preferred. And so that just goes to show, like, we really don't know, right? We don't know what the other person is thinking. And with their personality and everything, yeah, we can guess, but sometimes we're way off. And so we compiled all those answers and, like, we have that now. So la samahallah, la qadarallah, you know, if anything were to happen in your future, we have something where we can feel good about going back and referencing and saying, this is how they said that they wanted things to be. And then what does that do for us as their loved ones, being able to facilitate that for them at the end of life? That's really blessed. That's a gift.
And kind of in a more of a concluding note, and this may be a little off subject, but often, you know, if you've read about, like, you know, Bowen's theory of, like, family systems and things like that, they always talk about, how do you handle conflict? How do you handle, you know, difficult and straining situations upon family members and their relationships and emotions between them? From what you've noticed of people trying to reconcile, let's say, between siblings or parents in those moments, right, what have you seen that, say, you know, you have all the logistics down, you have everything discussed, but there are just these, you know, these relationships that have kind of not been nurtured over time, and they've either metastasized into something violent, emotionally violent, or they have just kind of strayed? For people that are going to experience, let's say, the death of a sibling, or the death of a spouse, or the death of a parent, right? They're all going to experience a similar amount of loss. How can they better prepare themselves so that they recover from those past traumas and to prepare themselves better?
Are you referencing, like, somebody who has a perhaps not so healthy relationship with a person who's dying or died?
Yeah,
I've definitely seen that. I think that
they want to feel more, but they want to feel less, right? Or they don't feel that their feelings are commensurate or whatnot, or they feel that because they have been repressing a lot of emotions, that it's just coming out now in this ball of fire.
I feel like you're referencing something really personal.
No.
I know, something really specific.
Yeah, because I've seen this constantly in when I was doing chaplaincy. Like, you know, you're talking to, let's say, an older parent, I remember, like, who's passing away in their 90s or 80s, and they're 50 or 60 year old son or daughter is there, and they can't, they're like, you know, finally, thank God, right? It's like, or they're just like, okay, we're just ready for her to kind of move on,
right?
But you just see that there isn't an emotional lesson being taken away from this, or the other end of it, where, like, you know, strained relationships, and now this person is passing away, and it's just like, you know, you're crying, I should have done this, I should have done that. One way or the other, how can somebody prepare themselves to actually have the commensurate amount of care for this person that they can give them?
I think it goes back to a couple of things that running through my mind. Number one is, for you yourself, and this is going to be answered differently for each person, obviously, but what are your top five values? What are the things that you want to hold yourself to in terms of your standards? And when it comes to a family member or a loved one that you have with whom you have a strained relationship, what is the bare minimum that you will hold yourself accountable to? And again, that's going to look different for each person. But at the end of the day, knowing that this person is going to die and you are going to die, what will you have done to be able to let that relationship go and say, I did what I could with what I had at the moment, and according to my standards, this is what I could do, right? And so really thinking through that carefully. And the second piece I would think about, that's kind of like the pre-work. And the follow-up work is honestly like professional therapy. Having somebody who is qualified to be able to talk you through your history with the person, going through and untangling kind of that ball of emotions that is coming up or that's been suppressed, and be able to walk through that and learn how to carry it past that other person's passing, if that makes sense. So it's kind of like pre-work and then post-work that I would see.
Yeah. So when we look at dying, then it's something that the way we live is that way that we're going to die.
Yes.
You know, and it's you know, and that's also a hadith of the Prophet, right? The way we live is the way that we are going to die. And the way we die is the way that we are going to be raised at the end of the day as well. But inshallah, for those of you that are listening, you're able to take away and understand that dying is a difficult process, but it should not just be filled with misery. It actually should be us facing reality about the world that we live in, where we're passing into, how we're preparing ourselves to go into the hereafter, and understanding that working on ourselves and our relationships is very much so a part of preparing to enter into the hereafter and living our life gracefully and also passing from it gracefully. And, you know, and I'll end off on this point. Everything that Chaplain Sundas just spoke about, there's really only one person that I met in my life who who would actively speak about his own death like that, and it was Imam Suhaib Sultan. Like, I remember 2 weeks before he passed away, I was at his house, and he was just very openly talking about it. You know, he was very open just 2 weeks before. Look, like, I know, give me a couple of weeks, I'm not going to be here. I know it. Like, I'll be lucky if I make it into Ramadan. But he had everything picked out to who's going to wash his body, who's going to lead his janazah. And so much so, you know, I remember you were talking about the whole Mawlid thing. I remember at Suhaib's janazah, he had asked Yusuf Chuck, who is actually a friend of mine, his son, to literally recite salawat on the loudspeaker after his janazah was done, so that there was a sense of joy and, you know, in his passing. So people wouldn't remember it as a morbid occasion, but that there was a sense of joy associated to him passing. Yes. And the question that we have to ask is, am I leaving this world a more joyful place by the fact that I was present in it? Am I leaving more joy around for my loved ones to remember me by than as opposed to things that may have harmed them? And similarly, have I taken care of all the logistical arrangements which would otherwise be a burden on other people if I don't take care of those things? So that said, brothers and sisters, for those of you that are listening, this has been another episode of Faith in Fine Print. And Sundus, lastly, if people want to get in touch with you, how can they do so?
You can reach out to me on Instagram. My handle is by_thepen. I'm pretty good at responding to messages. I'm also on Facebook. I don't want to give my email publicly, but...
That's fine. Yeah, or just Google her, yeah. You know.
Sure, do that too.
This has been another episode of Faith in Fine Print. This is your host, Nihal Khan. Catch you all on the other side, literally and figuratively. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.